In the Voice of Russia World Service, we present the program Red Line.
Welcome to the Voice of Russia in its weekend program, The Red Line. Every weekend, we, Sergei Strokonь, Mira Salganik and Ekaterina Kudashkina, invite you to discuss the most significant events of the week. We are joined by Russian and international experts, politicians, scientists and artists, sharing or opposing our views on the vast and increasingly interdependent world shared by all of us.
We want our program to be personal, provocative and fair.
So this time we start with looking into what's happening in Syria. A major offensive launched by the Syrian government against protesters in the city of Hama is generally seen as a turning point in the Syrian uprising. It has prompted the UN Security Council to finally send a strong signal to Damascus to stop the bloodshed and made the international community, including Syria's close allies like Russia, toughen their stance on the issue. However, the chances of a new turmoil in the region have increased. At the same time, another crisis just across the Atlantic seems to have been postponed for at least another year or so. I'm referring to the US debt crisis and its aftermath, something we're going to discuss in our second section, Between the Lines. A last-minute solution which allowed the US and the rest of the world sigh with relief raises numerous questions with the expert community. Another drama, though of different nature, is the story of the former Egyptian president Hosni Mubarak, which we'll come to discuss in our final chapter, Man in the News. After 30 years at the helm of the country, he's facing judges from a hospital bed in a court cage, flanked by his sons and allies, all of them charged with conspiring to kill protesters during the January-February revolution and with some of the more traditional offense like corruption and mishandling public funds.
Well, Katya, as far as Mubarak is concerned, I think there's a lot of bitter irony in the story. Of all autocratic Arab leaders, he is the one who has stepped down in the most expedient way, with no big blood, at least compared to Libya and now Syria.
Yes, I would agree. He was the moderate one among them.
Well, but then this is how it often happens in big politics. So let us explore twists and phenomena starting from Syria, which is making world headlines one day after another, beyond the headlines. This is our first heading in which we will try to find whether Syria can turn into another Libya. I hope both of you, Sergei and Mira, agree that the events in the Syrian city of Hama, with government forces launching unprecedented offensive against protesters, have come as a major surprise for the world community.
Yes, as we see, the world community is engaged in a fresh round of diplomacy to work out consolidated approach on Syrian crisis. And, in fact, this is an uphill battle. I think that after Security Council's this Monday kick-started new deliberations on Syria, the eyes are largely focused on the world powers whom Western diplomats in UN headquarters in New York label as skeptics.
Oh, could you elaborate a little bit on that, Sergei? Could you tell our listeners who those skeptics are?
Yes, this is the key point, Katya, and the so-called skeptics, let us call them so-called, to name them, are China and Russia, first of all, two veto holding powers, and several temporary Security Council members, including India, who is currently presiding over the Security Council, Brazil, Lebanon, and South Africa. And their stand remains sort of a puzzle for Western partners. And let me just quote U.S. Ambassador to UN Susan Rice. We want to understand why others would not do the same, particularly in the light of what has transpired in the last few days. Well, I think this is an irritant remark.
Well, I would say I feel the same. By the way, President Obama pledged in the days ahead to continue to increase pressure on the Syrian regime and work with others around the world to isolate the Assad government and stand with the Syrian people.
So, all in all, Mira, I have a feeling that the world community has been divided into two camps, good policemen and bad policemen.
But let me tell you that the division is actually closing. Because, look, the Russia president, Dmitry Medvedev, has been quite explicit about it. In his recent interview, he said that if Assad failed to solve his country's problems, he's destined to, and I quote, a sad fate, and ultimately, we, meaning Russia, will also have to make some kind of decisions. By the way, Medvedev too compared the situation in Syria with the one in Libya, saying that unlike Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi, who ordered to shoot the opposition, Assad did not give such orders, but the death toll in the country is continuing to rise. I believe it's something like 1,600 now.
Yes, but let me say that the British Foreign Secretary, William Hague, also pointed finger at those nations who, at least till recently, showed no intention to support a new draft resolution on Syria, which was circulated in the Security Council this week. And here is just another quote, this time from Mr. Hague. There are nations on the Security Council opposed to any resolution, or they have certainly been in recent weeks. And we will revisit this in the coming hours and days. And that was said just on the eve of passing of this statement by the chairman of Security Council.
Okay. But then, Sergei, I believe that is also partly connected to the image of the UN Security Council and credibility, if you like, because we all remember what happened to the UN Security Council resolution in Libya.
Well, I believe Mr. Hague's words make a clear sign that Western powers are launching a fresh diplomatic offensive aimed to convince Russia, China, as well as other regional players from another camp to join the West the way it worked this February when adopting Security Council Resolution 1973 on Libya.
Well, That was my point.
No argument.
Well, if we analyze Russia's position in recent months, I think it has undergone changes, considerable changes. Let me just refer to President Medvedev's statement dated back to this May during the summit of G8 in Doha. He made a strong statement saying that under no conditions Russia would support new resolution on Syria, even if it is asked by the Western partners. And there was a logic behind these reservations, because Russia is very much embarrassed and confused in how Western partners mishandled resolution on Libya. But on the other hand, definitely President Medvedev turned out to be a flexible leader. He can't just simply bypass amid the new realities, changing realities in Syria, and all those atrocities, all those killings of civilians, they require definite action. So this is the reason I think that despite Russia's reservations, you know, on a new resolution, it tried to bridge the gap in understanding of the situation with the so-called bad policemen. And this statement by Security Council chairman, this is just a brainchild of diplomats of both camps.
Well, but by the way, talking about camps and diplomats, do you know that Russia's envoy to NATO, Dmitry Rogozin, said that NATO is planning military campaign against Syria this time?
Well, as far as I am concerned, I can hardly imagine how NATO countries without UN security resolution can launch something similar to what they have already been involved in Libya, in Syria.
Provided their hands full in Afghanistan, in Libya,
yeah, that's
and
what
other
I'm
countries.
Saying. That's what I'm saying. But definitely, Mr. Rogozin's statements makes us just to think over the situation once again.
Well, it's provocative.
So, yeah,
it's provocative.
I think Mr. Rogozin's message was that options are on the table. And
may I also intrude and try to introduce a pinch of common sense. The situation in Syria, and not only in Syria, is changing. The movement of the change is rather fast. So the approaches are bound to be changing. As for the comparison of Syria and Libya, of course it springs to one's mind immediately. But there is a difference, and incidentally, Libya, I believe, has taught everybody a very bitter lesson.
In the Voice of Russia World Service, we present the program Red Line.
And by the way, Syria plays a totally different role in the region.
But of course, I mean, there is a similarity, but I think that the divergence is much bigger.
Much stronger.
Well, much stronger.
But on the other hand, while the breach in understanding of the situation between two camps definitely is becoming more and more narrow, so still there's every reason to believe that Western powers, who unequivocally put the entire blame for the escalating hostility in Syria on President Bashar al-Assad, on his brutal crackdown on opposition, are confused by what they believe to be Russia's, Chinese, Indian and others' sort of stubborn approach. They expect much more from us.
Like what, for instance?
Well, according to them, inability to take swift decision, cripples the efforts of world community in a situation when it has to act with no delay. As you understand, every day of hostilities, which are already spreading from Hama to other Syrian cities, claims more and more lives, and this risks to provoke another large-scale civil war in the region, while we are already having one civil war in Libya.
By the way, let me interrupt you. The war in Libya is actually a result of a hasty action, unprepared action. And this is the general understanding of the whole of the expert community now.
That's right.
So that is the price.
But you will not deny that the situation in Syria can evolve in a dangerous direction and bears more and more a strong resemblance with the situation in Libya.
Look, Sergei, listen to me. You cannot go on indefinitely comparing Libya and Syria. There are certain similarities. Nobody disputes it. But there is a lot of difference, and I'd say that the divergences, the differences, are much stronger than similarities, and we should remember it.
Yeah, but you know, Mira, another interesting point is that some of the Western analysts I spoke to these days say that most of the skeptics are driven by their own domestic political agendas.
Well, everybody is taking into account the domestic agenda. Don't let us be idealists, for God's sake.
Anyway, when we speak about skeptics, their presumed inability to rush to throw their weight behind new Security Council resolution condemning Syrian tyranny underscores their own domestic problems with democracy. Well, according to Western analysts, when they speak about so-called skeptics, they say that their presumed inability to rush to throw their weight behind new Security Council resolution, well, in fact, underscores their own domestic problems with democracy. This is how they see it. And according to Western analysts, the West can't expect anything else from China and Russia, who value sovereignty and territorial integrity much more than the basic democratic values, which have to be protected. While the world community should not coddle dictators from Belarus and Syria to North Korea and Cuba. This is how they see the situation.
Well, look, Sergei, I'm sorry, but I think this approach holds no water. Let me cite you the example of India, say, which is the most populous democracy in the world. But it is not going to support this resolution on Syria. It made the problem clear. And India is not alone. There are others.
Yes. Lebanon, which is probably the most democratic and pro-Western state of the Middle East, also has its own reservations. And neither Brazil nor South Africa are autocracies which could have sided with President Assad on the principle autocracies all over the world unite.
So, what is the reason for the strong reservations, what do you think, which are voiced by the opponents of large-scale international interference in Syria with a stamp of approval from the Security Council, by the way? So, could you, Sergei, tell us more about that? What is your vision?
Well, as I already mentioned, the answer to the question obviously lies in the situation in Libya. As you know, Katya, Security Council Resolution 1973 is being grossly mishandled and misinterpreted by the NATO-led coalition to sheer disappointment of both Moscow and Beijing. And let me remind you that Russia and China both abstained from the February vote to give Western powers green light to do the job in Libya on their own risk. And tell me, what's going on in Libya now?
Well, Sergei, may I now say, the Russia and China abstained on that resolution 1973. Good guys, aren't they? But honestly, the example of Syrian mess, we can't call it otherwise than mess, is really preying on many minds. That is obvious. Now, what I want to say is that it's an open secret now that there is no real light at the end of Libyan tunnel till the Western countries, not NATO-led coalition, will stop supporting one party on their own choice against the other party.
And now you're being idealistic, Mira.
This is no way to bring it to reconciliation, right?
Yes, of course, which means that perhaps it would be a better idea to introduce UN peacekeeping force.
Well, for God's sake, I'm not going to decide this, Katya.
Oh, yes.
Thank you very much, but not me. Get me out.
In the Voice of Russia World Service, we present the program Red Line.
But my point is that when NATO got, so to say, when it interfered into the situation, it was taking sides.
From the very start.
It no longer can become a neutral force in that country.
Did it try?
I don't know. I don't think so.
That's my point.
Do you think they would be credited as a neutral party in the conflict?
Well, look, it would be a bit difficult after what has transpired already, credit them as a neutral party.
That's my point.
But an honest effort to take it into account that there is another point of view of the opposite party would do them no harm. On the contrary, it would make them a shade more credible.
Perhaps so. Perhaps so. I love your optimism, Mira.
Well, but at any rate, the last thing Russia wants is just to repeat Libyan scenario in Syria. And not surprising, Russia's ambassador to United Nations, Vitaly Churkin, while spelling out the reasons for Moscow's opposition to new Security Council resolution on Syria, noted, let me quote, "We are still under the shadow of events in Libya and frivolous action taken under the Security Council umbrella."
Well, I've seen that statement, but I have also noticed that Mr. Churkin, who, by the way, is one of the most experienced and seasoned and high-profile diplomats in Russian Foreign Service, hinted that there is no question of Russia's blunt no, or yet, if you want, to any decision taken by the Security Council. As he put it, if this tends to be a document which, in our view, will be productive for the people of Syria, we will be flexible. And finally, Vitaly Churkin called on the Security Council, and I quote, to send a strong signal for cessation of the hostilities. And that's what they did.
And by the way, President Medvedev's special envoy to the Middle East, Mikhail Margelov, went even further, denouncing in unexpectedly strong language President Assad's brutal crackdown on opposition and predicting that international condemnation might be followed by sanctions. And finally, we have already quoted recent statement by President Medvedev.
Yes.
All right. There is no hurry. And there is no doubt that shelling your own people with your own tanks is not good. Definitely not.
Very bad.
Indeed. Also, I personally, and I think you would support me, I don't believe in the armor arguments, in a squabble, in a fight.
At least against the civilian population.
At least a bit. Moreover, Katsi, let me remind you both, if you forgot another thing. This is not the first time that the government of Syria
attacked Hama.
Did I? That was, Sergei reminded me before we came into the studio. In 82, the number of casualties was very high. He did it. Well, of course, the time was different. It was the time of the standoff between the blocs. There was Russia and the United States and things. But no one, as far as I remember, made a squeak about it.
That's right.
So it seems that humanitarian missions of the big powers is a sort of selective method, right?
It has always been, Mira, hasn't it?
And so it will go on to be this, if you ask me.
And now we come to the good old question of the double standards in the world politics.
That's right. And no answer to it.
No answer to it. The question is purely rhetorical.
Right. Still, it comes to one's mind.
Yes, of course. We can't help thinking about that. So, do I get it right that you find that it is not the wish to protect the democracy that always makes the Western leaders respond, you know?
Gosh, not at all.
Well, Katya, let me remind you of the events of October 1993 in Moscow, when Russia's first democratic president, Boris Yeltsin, has ordered to shell Russian parliament with tanks. And tens of civilians were killed in the center of Moscow. And ironically, it was shortly after that that Russia was given a chair in the political club of leading democracies, of turning G7 into G8. And few years later, once popular President Boris Yeltsin completed his presidency with just obscure 6% of popular support, and he was mocked by the nation which once adored him.
Well, that's a telling story. But getting back to Syria, it really looks like the government has passed a point of no return, you know.
This is the Voice of Russia. And now on Redline, an expert opinion.
You could listen to Dr. Murhaf Jojati, professor of political science and international affairs at the George Washington University and also professor at the National Defense University's Near East South Asia Center for Strategic Studies.
the situation changed, and this was massive violence against civilians in the cities of Hama and Deir ez-Zor and Daraa. But in Hama alone, there were over 100 people killed, and throughout there are a reported 146 people or 150 people killed. This would make it the most murderous day in the Syrian uprising since March 15th. And this huge toll on civilian casualties, I think, has moved the violence to a new level, which has prompted several governments to not only further condemn Syria, but to begin to take even further measures against the Syrian government.
But what would you say has triggered this kind of change?
I think that the Syrian authorities fear the coming month of Ramadan. In Ramadan, after sunset and after the break of the fast, people go to the mosque. This is a daily ritual in the evenings. And so the fear of the authorities that the uprising is going to be further intensified. So this may have been the Syrian authorities' message to the protesters that they will deal with any unrest with even further violence.
But, sir, as far as I understand, army is one of the key players in the situation in Syria. But do you think that perhaps shooting at its own people imposes some kind of too large psychological stress, even on the military?
It is causing a lot of stress, and there has been even further defections. The number of defections from the Syrian army now are quite significant, and they are coming in to the side of the protesters even with their material. So this is beginning to be very, very serious. If the authorities do not stop this use of violence, they might trigger even further defection in the armed forces and the security forces.
But let's imagine that they stopped the violence. What could be the reaction of the people?
Well, it would at least calm the people down, because the further violence the authorities are using, the further they are enraging the protesters and making the protests swell. So that now even people in the silent majority who had otherwise been sitting on the fence are now beginning to join the protesters. This we know because the number of protesters has swelled dramatically in the past 2 weeks.
But then how shall we explain the, shall we say, such short-sighted policy of the current government?
The thinking in the Syrian authorities for the past 48 years has really been of state in its absolute control of society. The Ba'ath Party, the security apparatus, have never tolerated much dissent. And so they are in this security culture. They are socialized in the security culture, and they do not want to show any signs of weakness. The problem with this policy is the further they continue down this road, the further trouble they get into.
Oh, yes, because the policy is evidently backshooting.
It is totally counterproductive. It is isolating the Assad regime internationally. It is isolating the Assad regime domestically. And it is the Assad regime, I think, is digging its own grave in pursuing this highly negative policy.
So, do I get it right that a prospect of further sanctions against Syria is quite real now?
Absolutely, and I hear that the EU is going to enlarge the sanction and to include 5 more senior officials on the sanctions list, including the freezing of their assets and a travel ban. So the more the Assad regime acts this way, the more international sanctions it is getting and the more isolated it's becoming.
And my final question, as I've been talking to various experts in Syria, they kept telling me that at least up till now, there has been no alternative to Mr. Assad as the head of this country, which is playing a key strategic role in the region. So do you think that there is at least some opportunity that the government might introduce any, shall we say, changes in its stance, and under certain conditions, Assad could survive as the head of Syria, or perhaps it is absolutely unreal?
I think the more this goes on, the more it becomes unreal. The Assad regime has made itself to be no longer the legitimate leader of Syria. There is an emerging opposition. The opposition is increasingly united and providing the people with an alternative to the Assad regime. Even if Assad survives this, I think he's going to survive it only for a very limited amount of time, because having used such lethal force against his own citizens, I cannot imagine how he can continue ruling.
And obviously, when there is such a turmoil in a country, it tends to crumble along lines which are always there. So what could be done to prevent Syria from crumbling against ethnic or religious lines, for instance?
The scare that is put out of ethnic and civil strife in Syria is one tactic that is used by the authorities themselves. They are trying to scare Syrians and scare the international community into believing that if Assad goes, there's going to be a civil war in Syria. Well, the protesters have shown themselves to be united across ethnic lines and across sectarian lines, and it is a national uprising. It is not a sectarian uprising. And so here, this is only rhetoric that is put out by the Assad regime itself.
So, do I get it right that Syrian people who has been living side by side, various ethnic communities and sectarian communities, are still keeping together and they're still united by a common political idea? Is my understanding correct?
Your understanding is absolutely correct, and the evidence of this is in looking at the list of names of those who are in the opposition movement. And you have, in addition to many Sunni Muslims, you have even Alawis who are in the opposition. You have Christians, you have Syrian Kurds. And so this is truly a cross-national uprising against a dictatorial regime that has not hesitated to use violence against its citizens.
You are listening to the Voice of Russia, one of the oldest radio stations in the world.
And now we're moving to our next section, Between the Lines, in which we usually discuss what we consider to be a most notable and often provocative publication of the week. This time, we've chosen a column by Lawrence Summers, former Treasury Secretary under President Bill Clinton and currently a Charles W. Eliot University professor and President Emeritus at Harvard University. The column which he wrote for the British Financial Times is entitled Relief at an Agreement Will Give Way to Alarm and focuses on the recent U.S. debt crisis and its resolution. So his basic point is that, just let me quote from it, America's current problem is much more a jobs and growth deficit than an excessive budget deficit. On the current policy path, which involves a substantial withdrawal of fiscal stimulus, when the payroll tax cuts expire at the end of the year, it would be surprising if growth was rapid enough even to bring unemployment down to 8.5% by the end of 2012. With growth at less than 1% in the first half of the year, the economy is now at stall speed with the prospects of adverse shocks from a European financial crisis that is decidedly not under control. Spikes on oil prices and confidence declines on the part of businesses and households. Based on the flow of statistics, the odds of the economy going back into recession are at least 1 in 3, if nothing new is done to raise demand and spur growth. So if these judgments, Mr. Summers says, are close to correct, relief will soon give way to alarm about the U.S. economic and fiscal future. Now, I know that figures and economics are not the most provocative matter, but look, this is serious. An alarming U.S. economic and fiscal future is surely alarming for the rest of the world.
I thought you said that Summers was focusing on the debt ceiling deal. Or did he limit himself to saying that was not the most important issue?
Well, you know, talking of budget deficits, his forecast is that though the shabby spectacle, like he put it, is not going to be repeated for at least 15 months, an objective observer, I'm quoting, would now predict larger U.S. budget deficits than a few months ago. The economic forecast has deteriorated, and it is reasonable to estimate that even a half of a percent reduction in growth, averaged over 10 years, adds more than $1 trillion to the national debt by the year of 2021.
May I ask why does it have to be seen in the perspective of 10 years? right now we're discussing an immediate problem.
But an immediate problem...
Did I miss a point here?
Yeah, I think so. I think so, Mira, because we're addressing a problem which is a structural problem, and it needs a perspective of more than a couple of years,
you know? It's a structural problem. It's a systemic problem. That's right. But I don't believe that there is any economist who can predict the development in the next coming 10 years with that kind of precision. Anyway, don't let us go into
No, Mira, yeah, I suppose you're right in one thing, that this deal is really flawed.
Well, before we start discussing the future of the United States economy at large, do you think that we could take a closer look at the budget issue?
And I suggest we might remind our listeners of the basics just for starters.
Sure, we could do that.
In the Voice of Russia World Service, we present the program Red Line.
Just to remind our listeners, the U.S. government has a legal limit on the total amount of debt it can run up to pay its bills. The so-called debt ceiling has been there since 1917, and since then it has been raised quite a number of times, which is generally now seen as a formality. The limit just before the debt ceiling deal was closed was fixed at $14.3 trillion, as you well know, but the figure is impressive. Meanwhile, for the past decade, the level of public spending has been soaring, while tax revenues were not catching up with its growth.
Well, so the debt ceiling had to be raised, am I right?
Yes, of course.
And the spending has to be trimmed. Now, one of the ways to reduce budget deficit is to raise the taxes.
Well, quite so. But the
That's what we've been told in our secondary school.
Yes, but the Republicans who control the House of Representatives were opposing the tax increases. And at the same time, they were also saying that they wanted to bring the deficit back under control and threatened not to raise the debt ceiling unless a deal was reached.
So apparently a compromise has been reached involving spending cuts of more than $900 billion in return for an equivalent increase in the debt ceiling.
Well, you know, most analysts agree that the White House has achieved its goal of securing enough of an increase in the debt ceiling to get it past the 2012 election.
Now we are coming to the crucial point. Now, you said that the election, well, and not of resolving the debt issue.
I'm afraid not. In fact, Mr.
That's
Summers.
It.
Yes, of course. So he made several observations on the essence of the deal reached. The deal confirms the low spending levels already negotiated for the years of 2011 and 2012 and caps 2013 spending, where most would have expected this Congress to end up, he writes. Beyond that, and now we come to a crucial point, the outcomes are anyone's guess. The reality is that Congress approves discretionary spending annually, and the current Congress cannot effectively constrain future actions. The reality was, and still is, that discretionary spending will reflect the will of future Congresses. That was number one. And here is number two. Remarkably, for a matter so consequential, Mr. Summers goes on, the agreement the super committee will seek to reduce the deficit by $1,500 billion comes without any agreement on what the baseline is from which that figure is to be subtracted.
Remarkable indeed.
Fantastic. Which it really makes the deal look some kind of a makeup.
Well, that has been a rather widespread opinion after it was reached. And the basic concern is that spending cut is largely a political issue, and many doubt that target figures could really be reached given the state of the U.S. politics.
Katya, looking at the political side of it, Reuters quoting Michael Fulilove of Australia's Lowy Institute for International Policy as saying that Washington's handling of the crisis could have shaken confidence in the world's biggest economy, which is definitely a really valid point.
And the Chinese. The Chinese charged the United States handling of the crisis irresponsibly and immorally.
Well, little wonder, because China is the largest holder of the U.S. government debt. Japan, by the way, comes second, and the Japanese, too, sounded quite distressed. They said Japan hoped that the United States would take additional steps to stabilize the finances and head off the threat of a downgrade. This means that they're not wholly satisfied with the debt deal. And they have a reason, look. And it brings us almost to where we started. Despite the passage of a bill to raise the country's debt ceiling, the credit rating agencies could still have the U.S. debt downgraded. And now that spells a lot of trouble for the rest of the world, not only for the U.S. And here's what Ivan Chakarov, chief economist on Russia and CIS countries with Renaissance Capital, told us about that.
And now on Redline, an expert opinion.
Probably we should start from the fact that the United States is still the largest economy in the world in terms of GDP. I think despite the rising relative importance of many emerging market economies, in particular in Asia, I think still many look to the United States as the beacon of growth. And I think that, once again, if we see some kind of downgrades there, we could have an implication for many, many economies. So which ones in particular might suffer? I think that actually the European economy might suffer a lot. The European economy might suffer more in relative terms than the Asian economy, mainly because of the confidence channel. As you already know, the European economies themselves are going to severe debt problems at the moment, and I think that if downgrades in the United States were to lead to generalized increase in global uncertainty, I think this will have implications on the European economy. Yes, I think that China could be affected, but I think much more marginally, because still it's a big economy as well. There is a more robust or increasingly robust domestic demand that I think could insulate to some extent China from what is going on in the United States. But again, for me, the key casualties here could actually be the Eurozone economies.
But China is the largest U.S. securities holder.
Yes, that is correct. And I think the channel that you might be, or what you might be implying, is that if there is a problem in the United States, China might decrease its holdings of U.S. securities. But I think that, if anything, this could make the situation even worse for the United States. And I don't see why this necessarily might impact China from a growth perspective.
So what do you think could be done, perhaps, to sustain the U.S. economy if the need is really there?
Well, I think that we right now are looking at the probably second best solution, which is, yes, default will be for sure avoided, although we're still facing a couple of votes in the Senate and the House, but I think that we can probably assume that they will pass successfully. Again, the key issue for me right now, the next issue, is what will happen with the rating agency and whether, from their perspective, this plan that has been put on the table will be enough for them to conclude that this is another solution for them not to downgrade. And I think, again, this field of paramount importance at the moment. If S&P in particular, because they have been the most vocal in this debate, if they conclude that this plan is not enough and they downgrade, I think it could be very significant. Now, going back to your question, what could be done? I think it's very difficult for the United States to do something, because if anything, the government has to start cutting expenditures, and given the weakness of the U.S. economy, this could actually make the situation even more difficult. From another perspective, if you look at what the monetary policy could do, that is what the Federal Reserve could do, they've been already doing a lot. And I think that some, in terms of keeping interest rates very low, some have started to imply that maybe the Federal Reserve might engage into a QE3, another round of quantitative easing, as a possible way to counteract a slowdown in the U.S. economy. But my personal opinion is that the bar for a QE3 has been set very, very high, and I really doubt that they will do it. But this is one avenue that could potentially be explored in the United States if we indeed see some significant slowdown in the U.S. economy. But you're right to point out that there are much more fundamental problems, and these problems refer to healthcare costs in the United States. These problems refer also to the demographics, and I think there are very, very difficult choices that the United States has to make. And again, for me, the key ones are really addressing the rising healthcare costs. Unfortunately, this is not easy thing to do. And given the life cycle of a politician, of the life cycle of what a political cycle constitutes, it's very difficult for the policymakers in the United States to address these issues, because they're not popular. And again, this is the key problem. This is the key problem in the United States. This doesn't sound very, very promising for the United States, unfortunately, in the longer term.
But here again, we're seeing that curious mix of economics and politics. And I start to wonder, could that be the ultimate cause of the economically developed countries running into huge economic trouble?
Well, I would know. I know that there has been a ceiling given to debt, but there is no ceiling to hope.
This is the Voice of Russia.
And now we shall move on to Red Line's concluding section, Man in the News. This week we are going to talk about Mr. Hosni Mubarak, former president of Egypt, who this week was flown to Cairo to be tried on charges of corruption and ordering the killing of protesters. In fact, he stepped down this February following weeks of mass protests. Some 850 people were killed and 6,000 injured in mass demonstrations that finally forced Mubarak to step down. However, what is supposed to be a historic trial, the first such trial of the former Middle East ruler after his ousting from power during so-called Arab Spring, can well turn into a double-edged sword. And its initial start, the trial has already divided Egyptians into those who blame Mubarak for all the perils of his 30-year rule and those who admire him, feeling nostalgic for the old golden age.
Ironically, it was the new rulers of Egypt, the generals who were once a part of his team, his inner circle, that took a decision to put him in a court cage.
I agree, there is a lot of confusion over this trial. At the very initial stage it started. Ironically, the trial opened in what was called the Mubarak Police Academy.
Mira, and more ironically, Mubarak is the only Arab leader who resigned without dragging his country in a bloody nightmare, like Muammar Gaddafi and now Bashar al-Assad, who are just bombing and shelling their own people.
Well, but don't you think that this trial is sending them a strong signal? Yet no doubt, let me go on. He proved to be much more tolerant, much more flexible than the others. But this didn't prevent the new authorities, the people who once were eating out of his hand, to demand that he be put behind the bars on a stretcher too.
Well, and with no mercy too. Now, Mubarak, who has been since April under arrest at a hospital in the coastal resort town of Sharm el-Sheikh, was wheeled on a stretcher into an iron cage from where he will have to account for his 30 years at the helm of Egypt.
The doctors insisted that ex-president was in poor health, but the governing Supreme Council of the Armed Forces declared he was well enough to be moved to Cairo for trial.
Don't you find that government's decision was prompted by necessity to somehow placate masses of protesters equally skeptical of new authorities' ability to bring about changes in the country? Moreover, just think that Mubarak's trial might reveal facts the military would rather keep undisclosed.
Well, Kada, I think you do have a point. Egypt now is going through a highly volatile political phase. There are new protest waves, and it appears that protesters have made their key demand swift prosecution of top officials of the former regime. But what is the list of the charges against Mr. Mubarak? What specifically he is accused for?
Well, look, the list is very impressive. It is, of course, the killing of the people, rather ordering to kill the protesters during the Egyptian revolution, then impropriety in the sale of the villas and palaces and what have you. And also there is what is common in the Middle East, and not only there, it's the corruption, it's the nepotism, and...
Well, just to name a few, right?
Yep.
So, and please note, Sergei, that Mubarak is tried alongside his two sons, Alaa Gamal, and former interior minister, who has already been sentenced to 12 years of prison for corruption.
Yes, and interestingly enough, though both Mubarak and his sons deny absolutely every charge against them, the ex-security chief is sort of singing.
Oh, is he?
Yeah.
The justice minister said Mr. Mubarak could face death penalty if found guilty of murder.
That's it. If found guilty. But how can you find out who gave actually the orders to shoot? Whatever there was written or spoken commands given, one doesn't know. So find the evidence against Mr. Mubarak is a rather vague prospect.
Well, moreover, Mira, I believe that if Mubarak does get death penalty, which is traditionally carried out by hanging, even this will not solve the enormous problems of whatever government of Egypt.
In the Voice of Russia World Service, we present the program Red Line.
Look here, I guess before we proceed any further, we ought to remind our audience, however sketchily, of Mr. Mubarak's role in 30 years of his presidency, as well as of the problems it has left.
Yes, Katya, absolutely, you're right.
So, just let me try. Mr. Mubarak took the office in 1981, soon after assassination of President Anwar Sadat, and understandably, he made stability the watchword of his rule, with emergency law, which prevented gatherings of more than five persons, lasting throughout the 30 years of his stay in power.
Attaboy.
Anyway, he was born in a small village in the Nile Delta, but despite his humble origins, he graduated from Egypt's military academy and moved on to become commander of the Egyptian Air Force and deputy minister of defense. He played a decisive role in Yom Kippur attack on Israeli forces in Sinai back in 1974, for which he was rewarded 2 years later when the then President Sadat appointed him his deputy.
Yet internationally, Mr. Mubarak became known for his involvement in Camp David peace deal with Israel.
I'm coming to it. So the deal cemented his relations with the US, which supplied the country with billions of dollars as military aid. To the West, Egypt became a key ally, a voice of moderation on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
However, many in Egypt did not support his policy.
Well, not all of them could be really called Islamic extremists.
Exactly.
Though the government branded them as such to justify the draconian regime that it maintained. Egypt was regarded as the most stable country in the Middle East, but what was the price it had to pay for the stability?
Let me try to reply your question, Katya. It was a combination of poverty, social exclusion, anger over corruption, and personal enrichment among the political elite, and a demographic bulge of the young generation that could not find work.
But this is an explosive combination.
It is.
That detonated under the impact of Tunisian revolt. And Egyptian revolution was immediately hailed as turn to democracy, particularly in the West. However, the new wave of unrest, which is rolling over post-Mubarak Egypt these days, throws up huge challenges for the new government. Can you agree with this?
Well, with expectations raised by the revolution are high, the economic conditions are abysmally poor. There are shocking levels of unemployment and underemployment, a volatile security situation, and there is no scapegoat like Mubarak any longer.
Yes, that's right. The reasons for the present unrest in Egypt are more pragmatic than ideological. Look, the country's population is over 80 million. 17%, which is a considerable portion of the population, live below the poverty line. Median age is 24. And 43% of youth are out of work, meaning almost half of the young people who live in the country. So the way I see it, it is not the outcome of Mubarak's trial that is going to determine the immediate future of Egypt.
Well, still, it does not detract from the significance of the trial. And it's as a kind of a summing up results of these decades of rigid authoritarian rule.
My hunch is that the trial is overly politicized.
Well, it couldn't be but politicized. It was politicized from the very start.
And
but,
the investigation...
You know, there is a lot of drama, guys, I'll tell you, because I've been reading the papers rather carefully. The judge who is presiding over the trial, a certain Mr. Rifat, seems to be, you know, the exemplar. The model judge, and he wants to upkeep his reputation. He's got every right. I don't think that he'll be given any chance, because evidence produced last afternoon in the courtroom was, you know, a jacket soaked in blood, masses of, you know, weaponry. How does it prove anything?
Proves nothing.
It's going to be politicized. But I would like to add something more, if I may. The whatever is the outcome of the trial might be anything, including death penalty. I mean, you don't know. The situation is charged.
In the Voice of Russia World Service, we present the program Red Line.
You know, when I spoke to human rights activists in Egypt, they were telling me that the whole investigation has been carried out too hastily to be credible.
Of course.
And that is not...
Nobody's going to believe it.
And that is not what the new Egyptian government really is aiming at. They need to be a credible regime. They need to be a democratic regime. And the whole procedure fails to answer to meet those standards.
Yes and no. Yes and no. Yes, they'd rather prefer to be a credible regime. That's very important, given the international role of Egypt, too. But they are military. They are generals. And generals...
The judiciary are not.
No, but the council, the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces, they are generals. On the other hand, let me add one thing more. There is that man, Professor Asuri, who is representing more or less the Muslim Brotherhood. So he recently sounded a good signal to all liberals, progressives, Democrats. He said that, okay, so it's 43% of the people, of the adult voters, who are illiterate. But everyone has the right to vote. This should be remembered.
This should be remembered, but my final point is that if, well, we don't know whether the whole process is going to be a booster for the democratic change in Egypt,
no.
But I tell you what, it could backfire. Seeing the 30-year
of stability.
President. That's right, Mira. You just took it out of my mouth. 30-year stability history. Seeing this president who was presiding over that period, hidden in the cage, on a hospital bed, that could really make people sympathetic.
Not all of them.
Of course not all of them. But I see that this could be basis for unrest.
It's a powerful factor, I agree.
And quite a powerful image, by the way.
Well, but Katya, you mentioned democracy. So as far as democratic changes in this country, I would like to quote Mr. Yevgeny Primakov, who is the former Russia's foreign minister and a notable expert in Middle East affairs. And in one of his recent interviews, he said, "I don't think that democracy based on a European model is possible in the Arab Spring countries." And I think we have to take this opinion into consideration. Mr. Primakov knows the Middle East very well. He visited this region a lot of times. He knows personally Mr. Mubarak and other Arab leaders. And this is the conclusion he comes to.
I agree, Sergei, fully, totally. And if there are democratic changes, whatever they are not going to be the Westminster type.
And with this, we end this edition of Redline, brought to you by the Voice of Russia radio station. It was presented by its founders, Sergei Strokin and Mira Salganik, and myself, Ekaterina Kudashkina. Thank you very much for staying with us. Goodbye and take care.
Take care and goodbye.
So long.